The headlines, President Vladimir Putin says Russia's interests are non-negotiable, but insists that Moscow is looking for diplomatic solutions to resolve the standoff with the West over Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State cancels his planned meeting with the Russian foreign minister, accusing Moscow of beginning an invasion of Ukraine. And Israel launches surface-to-surface missiles from the occupied Golan to target an area in southwestern Syria. Our top story for this half hour, starting with the escalating crisis between the West and Moscow over Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin says Russia is still ready for negotiations, but that some topics are simply off limits.
Our country is always open for direct and honest dialogue, for the search for diplomatic solutions to the most complex problems. The interests of Russia, the security of our citizens are non-negotiable for us.
In a video address on the occasion of a public holiday, Putin said the Russian military will stand up for national interests. Moscow has moved to recognize the two self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine and ratify friendship treaties with them. Russia is also planning to deploy its peacekeepers to Ukraine, but Western leaders continue to claim that Moscow is preparing a full-scale invasion. And they've even started imposing tough sanctions targeting Russia's financing sector. The Kremlin says it has no plans for invasion and that it's evacuating its diplomatic staff from Kiev for safety reasons. The U.S. imposes new sanctions on Russia as Moscow orders troops into the two breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine.
We're implementing full blocking sanctions on two large Russian financial institutions, VEB and their military bank. We're implementing comprehensive sanctions on Russian sovereign debt. That means we've cut off Russia's government from Western financing. It can no longer raise money from the West and cannot trade in its new debt on our markets or European markets either. Starting tomorrow and continuing in the days ahead, we'll also impose sanctions on Russia's elites and their family members, as with sanctions. Who in the
Lord's name? Biden described the peacekeeping mission as the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. He also authorized the deployment of additional forces and equipment to the Baltic region. Biden said the West is united in defending Ukraine against what he called the Russian aggression. Separately, the White House said a possible summit between the U.S. and Russian presidents is now out of the plans. The American Secretary of State has likewise canceled a meeting with his Russian counterpart. Meanwhile, Ukraine is considering severing diplomatic ties with Russia. The country has also drafted reservists despite ruling out a general mobilization.
There is no need for the general mobilization today. We need to bring up to full strength the Ukrainian army and other military units in a speedy fashion. As Commander General of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, I issued a decree to recruit reservists during a special period.
Zelensky accused Russia of preparing for military aggression but played down prospects of a large-scale conflict. He called on his Western allies to quickly impose sanctions on Moscow. The West has already imposed a raft of sanctions on Russia. The most significant of such measures, Berlin has frozen the multi-billion-dollar Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is to carry Russian national gas to Germany. EU foreign ministers have also unanimously agreed on, quote, an initial sanctions package against Moscow. The Russian foreign ministry has slammed the West sanctions as illegitimate. Iran, meanwhile, has called on all sides to exercise restraint, warning against any measures to further escalate tensions. Well, to give us further insight on the unfolding tensions over Ukraine, we're now joined by journalist and political analyst Fred Weir, who's joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. We also have historian, political analyst, and author Markus Papadopoulos, who's joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Weir. Give us your initial thoughts on the recent comments made by the Russian President Vladimir Putin in this regard.
Well, it's pretty clear that the diplomatic path is finished now. It's if you remember, it's been like over 2 months, almost 3 months, that it's been going on. There was a process. It was very hopeful. It was managed from the top. And there are clear deals that struck that wouldn't have involved any pain. Neutralization of Ukraine, a reorienting of it so that it opens to east and west, and perhaps extending that to other post-Soviet countries. That was something that probably could have been negotiated, but the Russians are absolutely adamant. You can blame them as much as you like, but they will not tolerate a Ukraine that's drifting into the NATO orbit, becoming a de facto NATO military power, and eventually solidifying Ukraine as part of that bloc, which Russia regards, with some reasons, as hostile. So Putin has gone to his plan B, and therefore all the negotiating tools, bilateral with the Americans and NATO, or implementing the Minsk II Accords within Ukraine, which would have federalized Ukraine and therefore satisfied Russia's demands.
Marcus Papadopoulos in London, give us your thoughts on the fallout up until this point. The United States has decided to impose new sanctions on Russia as Moscow is ordering troops into the two breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. Where do you think that this situation is headed at this vantage point?
Well, ever since the American-engineered coup in Kiev in February of 2014, which saw Ukraine enter America's sphere of influence, Russia has been preparing itself for the most stringent American sanctions that the world has ever seen. So Russia has not been idle in the last 8 years. It has taken numerous steps, numerous precautions to safeguard the Russian economy against American sanctions. And what we see unfolding now is in no way the fault of Russia, because one of the reasons as to why Russia has amassed its forces along the Russian-Ukrainian border was to try and obtain political concessions from Washington, specifically security guarantees, in that America would put into writing that Ukraine would never become a member of NATO, and that America would comply with the NATO-Russia Founding Act of 1997 and withdraw NATO forces from Eastern Europe. But alas, the Americans were not interested in finding a diplomatic solution to the Ukraine crisis. They are not interested at all in relinquishing their foothold in Ukraine, because they want very much Ukraine to become a member of NATO, which would see Russia completely enclosed on its western border. So Russia had to act, and Russia has acted, and has acted clinically. But also at the same time, Russia didn't have any alternative. Why? Because a great many people in the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic hold Russian citizenship. And the constitution of the Russian Federation states that a Russian citizen falls under the protection of the Russian armed forces. So Vladimir Putin had no option but to recognize the DPR and also the LPR. And we also have to acknowledge that there is an atrocious disinformation campaign being peddled about Ukraine regarding Ukraine. And that is something that a great many ordinary people in both America and Britain are completely oblivious to, because they are of the impression that Russia is an alien country in Ukraine, which of course is anything but the truth.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political analyst Fred Weir joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. And thanks to historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos, speaking to us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, the Israeli military has once again carried out a missile strike against Syria. Earlier, our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us to give us more details.
An official military source here in Syria confirmed that there has been an attack and said that about 12:30 a.m. local time, the Israeli enemy, and I quote, carried out an aggression, launching a number of surface-to-surface missiles from the direction of the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some military points for the Syrian army in the vicinity of Al-Quneitra in the southern part of Syria. And this attack led to caused some material damage. Now, this is the third Israeli attack just this month. The previous ones targeted the vicinity of Damascus. Definitely, this is not a surprise for the Syrian army or the Syrian government, because this has been happening since the start of the crisis. And almost every time there's an attack, Syria makes sure to send letters to the United Nations to inform them and stress that such attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria, because those attacks aim to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities in fighting terrorism on the ground. So definitely this is not a surprise. Definitely Syria always stressed that this is, of course, this undermines Syria's sovereignty. It is against international law and the UN Charter. However, we still see international silence over repeated Israeli attacks.
And Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have marched to drum up support for Al-Quds as they mark the 53rd anniversary of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Asher Shannon reports from Gaza.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of ending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Well, stormy weather pummels Australia's southeast, Queensland, and parts of New South Wales, causing widespread flash floods. While flood water has covered roads and stranded vehicles, several areas have issued flood warnings. A woman has been found dead in a submerged car while 10 people are missing. Search and rescue operations are in progress. Weather experts forecast that storms are going to linger throughout the week in New South Wales and Queensland. That is a warning that severe weather may cause dangerous flash flooding and record rainfalls. Inflation in Italy continues to grow, reaching levels last seen over 25 years ago. This is while energy prices have been on the rise and look to increase further due to escalating tensions in Ukraine. Our correspondent Max Giuliani has more from Rome.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2%, with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Lugansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Siyu tu.
Çoman.
Yani?
Bazaar. Historically, each epoch has a particular industrial growth spurt. At present, what we are witnessing is another industrial shift, but this time it is towards knowledge-based products. These items have allowed several processes in our lives and industries to become faster and more efficient. For example, medical devices such as the hemodialysis machine have helped treat illnesses that were previously lost causes. The development of knowledge-based products is also important for the preservation of the environment and protecting it from harmful matter such as industrial waste. It's hard to imagine what our lives would look like without these items.
Hello once again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar with me, Sarah Dema. This time, we are going to venture through Iran's knowledge-based productions. We will uncover who makes these products and why they are important to all industries in the country. We will also check out how the government is supporting knowledge-based companies in developing new advanced technologies. So get comfortable and let's start the show. This time, our journey took us to the city of Apar in Zanjan province, where we visited Fanovarone Zistkore. This knowledge-based company was established nearly a decade ago and is active in three fields of laboratory work, research, and production of advanced machinery. The beating heart of this company is its advanced lab, which is trusted and certified by the National Environmental Protection Agency. Plus, it's part of the country's strategic technology lab network. Its labs are equipped with environmental monitoring technology as well as other instruments to carry out specialized research. Currently, its extensive lab cooperates closely with various industries, including hospitals in the field of environmental pollution monitoring, and acts as a research center for future innovations. This knowledge-based company provides many research services through its laboratories. For example, it previously carried out research projects in the field of oil refinery liquid waste. Another project was research on the treatment of synthetic resin sewage discharge using synthesized photocatalytic nanocomposites. These are used to gauge and remove pollutants in liquids for purification purposes. This company actively exchanges scientific information both nationally and internationally and regularly publishes its findings in academic journals at home and abroad. It collaborates with academic institutions and other research-based firms, providing them with test results. The government has been shifting more and more towards a knowledge-based economy that thrives on research. So knowledge spillover plays a big role in entrepreneurship, especially in cross-discipline research. Having labs in the country dedicated to advancing specialized research is very important. These types of knowledge-based companies help expand products in the market that may have been previously imported.
It was the first company in the country to apply science for manufacturing wastewater treatment and purification. Its manufacturing workshops are massive, with a cumulative area of over a hectare to produce the giant water treatment systems. Its machinery is used in industrial settings where water is refined and returned to the system for reuse. Furthermore, its machinery has helped preserve valuable water resources nationwide. Some sectors that apply this technology are the food industry. In general, all industries that use water to produce their products are the end user of this company's water purification machinery. All of the technology produced here is manufactured along the lines of European standards. Its capabilities and products have been exported to regional areas, including Europe. As part of its future goals, this company wants to expand its product list and increase its exports. It's noteworthy that this company has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Among its staff, this company employs the capabilities of environmental engineers, among other experts, on its roster. Among its many competitive advantages, one can name the high-quality material that is used for productions of its water purification systems. But that's not all. This company has played a big role in creating technology that preserves all the fine qualities of water using advanced machines for purifications.
Iran has been supporting the shift to a knowledge-based society by implementing plans that empower companies in their efforts to develop advanced technology. In fact, in 2010, the government passed laws promoting and supporting knowledge-based companies as part of a legal framework. This has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many social and economic advantages.
In 2013, there were only 50 knowledge-based firms and startups. That figure has grown over the years to well over 6,000 companies, according to the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology. A diverse range of products is manufactured by these firms to meet the country's rising domestic demands. This has saved the country millions of dollars by reducing expensive imports. Iran makes thousands of different types of specialized technologies. The amount of progress of knowledge-based firms in the fields of medical devices, energy, and information communication technology is the most noticeable. Aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals are among other disciplines researchers are focusing on. And exports of knowledge-based products are estimated to reach over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's based on figures from the Science and Technology Office. The National Innovation Fund says tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. Some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market as well. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. Some of these schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports.
Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries, and continents. They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings, and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the vast world of Iran's wire and cable productions. We wanted to see who makes these items and why they are so important to numerous industries across the country. Plus, we will check out some of this industry's contributions to the national economy.
To become more familiar with wire production, we visited Behtab Hadideh Alborz. It began its activity 5 years ago in the field of production and distribution of wires and cables. This company makes dozens of different types of wires and cables. Some are used in telecommunications, construction, electrical appliances, and automobile manufacturing. It also makes more complicated cables, such as coaxial cables. This type has an inner conductor surrounded by an insulating layer that is covered by conductive shielding. Currently, its production facilities have the capacity to make millions of meters of cables each month. Some 40 people work directly at this company, and 200 others are indirectly employed. It manufactures cables through a process of pulling either copper or aluminum cords. Advanced machines are used to stretch the metal conductors to the desired width. After this, depending on the use, the strands are either braided together or aligned and prepared for insulation covering. It is worth mentioning that this company has been producing wires and cables that were previously imported. Its productions have gained a significant share of the domestic market, too. Such domestic productions have prevented large amounts of capital flight throughout the years. It might be interesting to know that 95% of raw materials needed to produce wires and cable can be domestically supplied. Because Iran is rich with natural resources, raw materials such as copper, aluminum, and petrochemical products are easily accessible to this industry. There is a small number of items that still need to be imported, such as sheath required for aluminum cables. One of the advantages of this company is its diverse product range. It also has the capability of producing special types of cables to meet specific customer requirements that may currently not exist in the country. Remarkably, a key competitive advantage of this company is its technical know-how and experience. This has helped it manufacture its production machines and equipment and localize this technology in the country. Using its own machines has other benefits too, such as being able to maintain and control the quality of their products. Quality issues are very important in the cable industry. This cable manufacturer follows stringent specifications for the quality and safety of its wires and cables. Products are checked in the quality control center for their performance as well as to match other standardizations necessary in the sector. It's important to have the highest quality because wires are meant to last for years and sometimes for decades. Therefore, this company uses the highest grade of raw material to produce its items. As part of its future goals, this company is adding new products to its portfolio, such as fiber optic cables. But that's not all. This manufacturer stands on the cusp of exporting its products and plans to expand its market reach to neighboring countries as well. Generally speaking, the country's wire and cable industry has witnessed exponential advancements over the years and has been developed in line with modern technical knowledge. Based on statistics from the industry, Iran produces more than what is needed for domestic consumption, so export-oriented production is an important aspect to keep this industry thriving. The National Wire and Cables Producers Association says over 80% of the country's needs are supplied domestically, and productions compete in quality with global brands. But the association says that exports are negligible compared to the large production outputs. Moreover, it estimates that Iran has the potential to sell at least $600 million worth of goods to neighboring countries annually. Yet the value of current exports is less than $100 million. So why is this? It's because this sector is only working at 30% of its entire capacity as it faces several obstacles for expansion and development. Industry participants say they can work at full production load if many of these challenges are removed. Increased production can also lead to more exports. Some of these challenges include the supply of machinery. More often than not, business owners are forced to go through multiple intermediaries to get the equipment they need. Doing so is time-consuming and adds to their costs. other issues revolve around export barriers such as Iran's tariff system. Industry analysts say this system has inflated the end price of local products, sapping the country's competitiveness and exportability. Manufacturers say strict government regulations have also led to many businesses foregoing the path of exports altogether.
The biggest consumers of wires and cables in the country are in the telecommunications sectors and electrical power industry. Electricity is the mother of all industries and is heavily dependent on wires and cables. Iran is capable of producing large amounts of electricity and fully supplies domestic needs. It exports electrical power too. This sector requires high voltage cables to be able to distribute electricity nationally and also internationally.
According to the Electricity Industry Syndicate, domestic firms already produce high-voltage power cables and are ready to export their goods and services to international markets. Previously, these cables were imported, but domestic production has reduced imports by 20%. As the country develops its manufacturing industries, it also creates an enormous demand for electricity. The national power grid has been expanded by 60,000 kilometers in the last 4 years to meet growing requirements. Consequently, manufacturers had to set up production to supply wires and cables to the electrical power industry. We looked at some figures from the National Power Generation Transmission and Distribution Company. Data showed around 80% of the productions of wires and cables in Iran is supplied to the power industry alone. The remaining 20% are used in electrical appliance, automobile, and construction industries, among others. It can be said that wires and cables play an important role in the electrical and electronic industry. The increasing demand for power, light, and communication has kept demand high for wires and cables. This industry has so much potential, promising a bright future for further development and growth. Iran has many natural resources. Some are agricultural and some other are natural wonders enjoyed by tourists and locals alike. Still, other resources have to be extracted by mining. The mining industry is a very important component of the economic health of Iran, contributing billions in a given year. This modern industry is also heavily dependent on the discoveries and innovations made by knowledge-based companies. These firms are often pioneers of development, opening new horizons for industries while making industrial processes more efficient and less costly.
One of the biggest capacities of Iran is its rich natural resources. Yes, we are talking about mines. They have brought tremendous profits while creating numerous jobs. This week, we will look at the mining industry and some of its related traits. We also want to uncover how this industry continues to expand and who is helping with its development. So let's start the show. Everyone, now I will pass it over to my colleague who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's take a look.
You definitely have a clear image of a concrete or a steel structure, but when it comes to tensile structures, you most likely cannot picture anything. They're self-standing structures carrying only tension and no compression. Mostly made of membrane or industrial fabrics, they're most often used for roofs and canopies, creating unique private and public spaces. Mahout is the name of an Iranian company that makes all kinds of tensile structures. Tensile structures can cover vast areas, While they're lightweight compared to other types of construction, they're extremely strong. Tensile fabric structures are designed and engineered to withstand even the most severe weather conditions, providing protection from both rain and sun. Mahout says its products are made using the latest technology and high-quality materials, on par with their international peers. Mahout has under its belt a dedicated team of experts who are constantly exploring new trends and efficient designs for eye-catching yet resilient tensile structures. While the Iranian brand has a strong foothold in Iran's market and is eyeing higher horizons, Mahout says it's working to undertake international projects. Offering a unique landscape for outdoor eateries, restaurants, and coffee shops, tensile structures are beginning to attract more attention in the architecture industry. This means the future market will be lucrative for the actors in this field. And Mahout says it will stand out, as it believes quality is in the details.
There is so much more that can be said about knowledge-based products, so let's take a look at some news and trends in this field. You have probably heard the phrase NFT, or non-fungible tokens, being thrown around recently. The very first Iranian NFT issuance platform was established and launched in the country.
The platform is called Beta. It was created by a company in the field of developing digital technologies in the information communication technology sector. Beta digitally certifies artistic and non-artistic works in the form of non-fungible tokens. The developer says it plans to increase international access and grow the platform's ecosystem to determine accurate asset values. People can purchase NFT that are backed by authentic art approved by the system and sold at auction.
Most people don't think twice about fungi, but what if it could be used to help treat diseases? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company has managed to come up with the technology to produce rare medicinal fungi.
This company focused on producing four species of medicinal fungi. Once cultivation conditions have been established, these plants can be mass-produced. Its medicinal properties will be used in the form of tablets and capsules. These fungi have the potential to treat liver disease, immune deficiencies, diabetes, and some skin diseases. Plus, the four species can now be cultivated in 3 months.
The number of cars and pollution increases as cities grow, and one way to manage this issue is to create specialized technology. Domestic knowledge-based companies and startups have developed 17 innovative products to improve road traffic and reduce air pollution.
The products were developed to address the rising number of vehicles and inner-city trips in cities nationwide. Some of these smart products are used to record traffic violations, collect traffic information, and license systems for restricted traffic zones, among many others. Smart traffic monitoring systems have also been developed by these companies.
We are fresh out of time for our program for today. Thank you for tuning in, and I will see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
the keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on chapter 3 of the social system of Islam, which is part 3 as well, and this particular topic is discussing the Islamic form, the Islamic system of building a municipality. How should a city be run from the Islamic perspective? It's a very important issue because it discusses a variety of things, from the Islamic approach to how to have a Muslim or Islamic image as far as a city is concerned. And although we've discussed a lot of social elements to how we need to interact with other citizens in a city, we haven't discussed what the basis of this city should look like from an Islamic perspective. And Islam does have a lot to say when it comes to building, when it comes to the dividing of, for example, responsibilities and things like that, what the public space should be, what the private dominion should be. A lot of these other very, very interesting things to do with cultural centers, religious centers, educational facilities, hygiene, public cleanliness, how a house should be divided and things like that. So it is indeed an interesting topic to look into, and there's a lot that all of us can benefit from. You know, you want to make sure that your sadaqah gets to the right place. You want to make sure that it is without any kind of minniya or favoring. You know, when you're giving something to someone, you want to make sure that you preserve their dignity, their respect. There's that very famous story from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When he gave charity to a beggar who came knocking on their door, he gave it behind the door. So he didn't allow himself to see the beggar. So he gave it like that. And then he was asked, why did you do that? He said, because I didn't want to see the person face to face. So the next time this person does see me, he doesn't feel humiliated, you know, that I gave him some sadaqah. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi reminds us that we need to make sure that we have pure intention. La khayra, he says to Imam Ali, Ya Ali, la khayra fil qawli illa ma'al fi'l. There's no benefit, there's no goodness in saying something unless you have your actions to back it up and support it. Wa la sadaqa illa ma'al niyya. And there's no sadaqa, there's no true charity giving unless you have the pure intention for it. Another important thing to keep in mind as far as the etiquette of sadaqah is concerned is to remember that when we are giving out charity, we're giving it from our halal money. And we're doing it ourselves. We're not delegating someone else to do it. We're doing it ourselves. It's me that's doing it. I am initiating in it. Another important thing to keep in mind as far as the etiquette of sadaqah is concerned is to remember that when we are giving out charity, we're giving it from our halal money. And we're doing it ourselves. We're not delegating someone else to do it. We're doing it ourselves. It's me that's doing it. I am initiating in it. Or from that food, you give out as charity. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam was asked, Ayyu sadaqati afdal? What sadaqah is the best form of sadaqah? What sadaqah is the best? Then he says, Anta tasaddaq wa anta sahihun shahihun ta'malu al-baqa wa takhafu al-faqr. That sadaqah that is given is when you are in your good states, when you are comfortable, when you are happy, you're giving sadaqah. Not when you have problems, then you start thinking of sadaqah. No, when you are normal, you know, be thankful, be grateful, show that gratefulness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by paying sadaqah. Sometimes you should be paying sadaqah sirran, which means privately. Sometimes you should be paying sadaqa alaniyatan, which means publicly.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
It is said that when you are paying sadaqah, it doesn't reach in that person's hand. It reaches straight into the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's from a hadith. Also, another hadith says that a sadaqah extinguishes, turns off the wrath of hellfire of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. And so sometimes you need to be giving sadaqah publicly to encourage others, but you keep your niyyah in being pure and sincerely for the sake of God. Sometimes you're also going to be giving sadaqah privately, also for the sake of you wanting to test yourself, test your niyyah, that, you know, all the absolutely nobody knows about it. Are you still going to do it? Or is it only you wanting to be there and do it for the sake of fame and other people praising you about it? Important thing is that when you are giving sadaqah, you are doing so in the best form and you're content about it. You know, you're not doing it with wanting to hurt someone. As the verse in the Holy Quran says, لا تبطلوا صدقاتكم بالمن والأذى. Don't invalidate your sadaqah by reminding them of your favor or by hurting them. You know, scream at them and say, okay, here, I'll give you a dollar. Or you don't humiliate them or degrade them or ask them to do, for example, some weird things or something like that. Another thing that's also important is if it is not your money, then you need to have consent of who it is that you are taking the money from. And this is in the case of a wife and a husband. If the wife is living off the husband's money, it's not her personal money, then she should have his consent when it comes to the payment of sadaqah. That's an important point that also Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions here. Inna imra'atan sa'alathu faqalat ya Rasulullah. A woman asked the Holy Prophet and said, ya Rasulullah, ma haqqu az-zawj 'ala zawjatih? What is the right of a husband over his wife? Then the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, in a long hadith, a part of it says, "An la tatasaddaq min baytihi illa bi'idhnih," that she doesn't pay sadaqah from his funds, min baytihi, and his funds, illa bi'idhnih, unless with his consent. And then Ayatollah Jawadi says that, well, if it's her money, then she doesn't need his consent if she is paying sadaqah. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.